This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. President Joe Biden was in Buffalo Tuesday speaking at a memorial site for the victims of the racist mass shooting that took the lives of 10 people and wounded three others. The massacre in Buffalo was only one of at least six other mass shootings that took place this past weekend.
This venom, this violence cannot be the story of our time. We cannot allow that to happen. Look, I'm not naive. I know tragedy will come again. It cannot be forever overcome. It cannot be fully understood either. But there are certain things we can do. We can keep assault weapons off our streets. We've done it before. I did it when he passed the crime bill last time. And violence went down. Shootings went down.
Now, that claim by the president about the 1994 federal assault weapons ban leading to a decrease in shootings has been disputed. But what is undisputed is the current violence and loss caused by guns. On Friday, 17 people were shot in downtown Milwaukee after an NBA playoff game. On Sunday, two people were killed and three critically injured in a shooting at a flea market in Houston. That same day, a man opened fire in a church in Laguna Woods, California, killing one person and wounding five. And according to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 200 mass shootings so far this year in which four or more people were shot. Following the shooting in Milwaukee, the city's mayor, Cavalier Johnson, instituted a curfew. And Chicago's mayor, Lori Lightfoot, also announced a citywide curfew in response to a highly publicized fatal shooting of a 16-year-old boy in Chicago. Lightfoot announced that she's changing the citywide weekend curfew for unaccompanied minors from 11 p.m. to 10 p.m. To talk about these policies and this history, I'm speaking with Jonathan Metzl. He's a professor of sociology and psychiatry and director of the Department of Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for being here, Dr. Metzl.
Thanks so much.
When I'm just kind of reading through those numbers, I feel like I almost have to dissociate a bit. Excuse me for using a psychiatry term there. But I guess I'm just a little stunned that this is still happening. You and I have been talking about this for at least a decade. And why am I still reading these kinds of numbers?
It really does feel like we're going backwards, and that's because we're going backwards. I mean, there was a CDC report that came out just a few weeks ago that looked at the first year after the pandemic hit, and it found that there were over 45,000 recorded gun deaths in the United States. That's a number that I, certainly as somebody who studies this, never thought I'd see. And I would also guess that that's probably an undercount because many gun deaths are not reported. And so in so many ways, we feel like there's more gun death around because there literally is more gun death around. And that happens in the context of just pornographic sales of guns that have been happening over the past 3 years in particular. And courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, considering really taking off all the brakes on who can buy a gun, where you can carry a gun. And so it does feel like this issue that many people on many sides of this quote unquote gun debate have been fighting for so long, it just feels like it's getting away from us. And I share that frustration, and I think it's real.
All right, let's dig in on this idea of the gun debate for a moment. One of the things I've learned from your research that I think is so stunning and challenging then when we get to this question of the gun debate is that it's become such a separate ideological issue that you demonstrate that even those who have directly experienced loss as a result of gun violence, whether it is someone taking their own life by the use of a gun or being victimized by someone else who's shot a family member, it's so ideologically connected that even those survivors of gun violence often will continue to support an almost unrestricted access to guns. What is going on with that?
Yeah, I found that when I was particularly doing my research on gun suicide for my book, Dying of Whiteness. I was living in southern Missouri and what people call gun culture. It is gun culture very much. And I was interviewing people who had lost spouses or children, parents to gun suicide. And initially during my research, I would ask people who had suffered like the most horrific loss. I mean, somebody who loses a child in such a I mean, it, honestly, such a predictable way. And I would say, did this change your attitudes about guns at all? And it was really the wrong question, because time and again, the answer I would get is, it's not the gun. It's not the gun's fault. They were almost sometimes offended that I would ask that, as if going through this tragedy would convert them from being Republicans to Democrats or something like that. And on one hand, I kept thinking, you know, of course, you know, these were the people who I think would be the most willing or, you know, urgently able to switch sides, quote unquote. But it did also make me realize just how much guns have become such deep identity issues and almost religious symbols for a lot of people, that in this moment of despair, they were holding on to the ideology that was the most powerful for them. And so in a way, at moments like that, they were probably the least likely to say everything I've believed in my entire life is wrong, or to think about possible culpability and factors like that. It was very, very complicated. And I certainly think we see that after, in a bigger scale, after mass shootings, where people who are pro-gun become much more pro-gun, and people who are more for restrictions become much more for restrictions. And so we have these debates in moments of crisis where people are really holding on to their ideological positions. And that's these are moments of tragedy. They're moments when people are paying attention, but they're also the time where people, I think, are the least able to form any kind of consensus about how to move forward.
I'm wondering if that's also what's going on when you're talking about sort of, you know, holding on to these beliefs about what works, even if there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't, because it also seems like that's what's going on with policymakers. Why curfews? Why? What difference does it make? First of all, to go, you know, in by 10 p.m. versus 11 p.m. And especially, I mean, we're reeling from Buffalo, which happened in broad daylight on a Saturday.
There's the level. I don't know what went into the curfew decisions, so I don't want to really speak to the specifics, except to say that it does seem like such a move of despair or frustration. I mean, the issue is that communities are not getting the kinds of help they need. Places like Chicago, for example, Chicago has reasonably solid gun laws, but if you can't stem the flow of guns coming in from Wisconsin or Indiana, anybody can just drive 20 minutes and load up their car with guns and come back, and many other factors as well that are leading to really what we're seeing in this country. And so it does seem like a desperation move in a certain kind of way. I mean, I think we should consider anything that helps and works right now, but as the research we've done at Vanderbilt shows, so much of quote unquote gun crime is really linked to upstream factors, structural factors that are not about who's on the street at 9 p.m. versus 11 p.m. It's much more about, other feelings of, guns, obviously, but also housing insecurity, economic insecurity, food insecurity, all these other factors. There are so many factors that go into this that it feels like, with respect to everyone who's trying so hard on these issues, it feels like window dressing if these bigger structural issues aren't addressed at the same time.
When you talk about these bigger structural issues, I guess I'm still trying to understand the different kinds of gun death. You've written about death by suicide using handguns. We're talking here about street violence occurring in urban centers. And then, of course, we have something like this racist mass shooting in Buffalo. These seem like dramatically different causes and purposes for the person making use of the gun. Is that part of the sort of pushback of well, guns didn't do it, and also social structural change can't fix it because clearly these are such different kinds of acts, because it does all end with people gone as a result of a gunshot wound, and yet they do feel very different.
Yeah, I agree. They are different in so many ways. I mean, the common denominator is the outcome. I think that's exactly right. I think that the point that we should push back on, though, is that again, we have these debates, understandably, after shocking, horrific mass shootings, but the problem I think we fall into sometimes is that we conflate mass shootings with all gun crime. And then people will say, well, there was nothing we could do to stop this one shooter, and therefore there's nothing we can do. And I think that's really the problem. As I was saying before, we have now well over, I think, 45,000 gun deaths a year in this country. Mass shootings are horrific. They kill anywhere from 400 to 1,000 people. That leaves a lot of other kinds of gun death. And gun suicide is overwhelmingly every year the most common cause of gun death, about 2/3 on average. Then you have gun homicide, partner violence, accidental shootings. And I think the important point about these other kinds of shootings is that they actually are predictable in many ways. They happen within social networks. You can predict who the high-risk people are going to be. If somebody has, for example, a history of violence in the past, they're more likely to be violent again in the future. Many other factors go into this. And so I think that the issue is, if we look at the totality of gun death, I think we can see that there are things we can do that are based in prevention strategies and safe storage, what are called red flag laws. I think the issue is, we need a national push to stop those other kinds, the more common kinds of gun death. But we don't do that, in part because of gridlock, and in part because mass shootings come to stand in for all shootings.
We are, however, moving towards potentially some big changes in gun laws and access. What's going on with the Supreme Court and gun control right now?
Yeah, it's not good, honestly. I mean, the Supreme Court is debating a case that is using a century-old gun law from New York that basically says that a city like New York and blue cities and states across the country have a right to regulate who carries a gun in public. And that makes sense if you think about New York. You know, you don't want people with an AR-15 on the subway or going to Times Square on New Year's Eve and things like that. But a number of gun owners, actually not that many, just two, have filed a suit supported by the NRA, basically saying that that's an infringement on their rights and that cities shouldn't be allowed to regulate that. And so if the case goes against New York, it's really going to lead to, I fear, almost an arms race in places like New York, because the city won't have any way of regulating who gets to carry a gun in public. Now, we have a two-tier system, or not even a two, just a split system in this country, right? Places like Nashville and other red cities, you can already pretty much carry a gun wherever you want. And so really, this is going to impact blue cities and states. And the question will be, do blue cities and states have a right to regulate who carries a gun in public? From a public health perspective, generally speaking, you see less shootings overall on an aggregate level in areas where you can have those kind of regulations. It's not that they're problem free, but I do think that if the Supreme Court goes against New York in a convincing way, it really will have profound negative implications, not just for New York, but really for the future of the American gun control movement that has based so much of its efforts on kind of the notion that that people have a right to have a gun in the home, but that carrying guns in public spaces is something that we should really think about on a case-by-case basis.
Just one more on this. The shooter in Buffalo was 18, and he purchased his gun legally. He wouldn't be able to purchase alcohol legally. What's going on with 18 to 21-year-olds and access to legal guns?
Yeah, it's not a mystery. It's certainly not a mystery. There's a pretty good body of public health evidence that particularly people ages 18 to 21 are in a pretty highly volatile group, not just about mass shooters, but about shootings in general. And I mean, you and I both teach college. I love college students. They're the best. But I wouldn't want to go to a college party with weapons and beer laying around and things like that. And so I think that a lot of the data is that particularly people who are kind of just figuring out the world in a certain kind of way are also among the more I don't want to call 18-year-olds dangerous, but I would say from a gun crime level, they're more likely to shoot first and ask questions later, I guess would be the gentle way to put it. And so I think that particularly people 18 to 21, now people on the other side would say, well, you can be in the military when you're 18 and you can, you know, all those kind of things. And so why not? But I would say that there's been a big red state push in Tennessee, for example, and other places to lower the age of carry, of public carry, from 21 to 18. And we've really just made it easier for people in that age demographic, not just to get guns without a permit, but to get it, really any kind of gun, long gun, handgun, things like that. And so I'm trying to be wary because I don't want to conflate this horrible mass shooter with everybody in that age group. But I would say that just demographic trends, not just about gun homicide, but also about gun suicide, think that this is a particularly risky group. And that for thinking about other kinds of gun injury and death, we really should think hard about what the impact is of lowering the age of carry from 21 to 18. I think we should reverse that, if nothing else.
Jonathan Metzl is director of the Department of Medicine, Health and Society at Vanderbilt University, and author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Thanks for being here, Jonathan.
Thanks so much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.